tonight, which is the return of Avshalom to Yerushalayim. As we recall, Yoav had orchestrated in a very unusual way, for reasons that we discussed, thought about. So Yoav had orchestrated Avshalom's return to Yerushalayim. And he does it via this Isha Chachama, a wise woman from Tekoa, who comes in with the whole story, the script. She's an actress, and she talks about her son, you know, who got into a fight and killed another son. And now the family's coming after him, you know, the tribe. And she's looking for protection, and there's Michael and Debbie. Wonderful to see you. We work that in seamlessly. And looking for protection. And David says, okay, fine, you know, I'll grant protection. And eventually it sort of comes out, the story is a little too coincidental, that this is all by way of a mashal, Yoav making the point to David that, you know, you have to let water under the bridge be under the bridge, if we can extend the saying that way. Let the water flow under the bridge, kind of, what happened, happened. You're not going to bring Amnon back. And there's no sense stigmatizing Avshalom for life. And, you know, David yields. And under the circumstances, Avshalom is brought back to Yerushalayim. But there hasn't been any kind of contact. There hasn't been any reconciliation as far as David and Avshalom are concerned. And that's a subject that we'll turn our attention to tonight. And that's an interesting story in its own right. And what I'll ask everybody to do is to try to bear in mind, I think many people are aware, if not everybody, that, you know, by next week we'll be talking about Avshalom's rebellion against his father. So I'd like everybody to try to pay attention to what we learned tonight from the perspective of what can we learn about Avshalom? How is our understanding of his character, of who he is as a person, as a figure in Tanakh, how is our understanding of him advanced? Now, again, we already know certain things about him. We know that he's capable of great violence. We know that because of what he did to his brother. As I've emphasized, we know that he's capable of great discipline as well. Remember, for years, he remained in utter silence and would not abide any discussion of what had happened to his sister. He waited for his moment. And what I am struck by is that dialectic. Very often, people who are capable of great violence are not also capable of great self-control. And vice versa, people who are capable of great self-control do not often lend themselves to great acts of violence. But I think what makes Avshalom a very nuanced character is that he is capable of great violence against his own brother, but he's also capable of great calculation, great discipline, striking at a particular moment. I think we could all agree, prima facie, that people who are capable of great violence are only made more dangerous if they're disciplined about it. Now, people who are impulsive and can't control themselves, right, they don't make it very, you know, high up the ranks. But the people who are very disciplined, know how to wait for their moment, know how to hide or even disguise their intentions, those people are more dangerous. And Avshalom he's in that category. But let's think about how tonight advances our understanding of him. Or does it reinforce some of these paradigms? Does it give us a different perspective, a newer perspective? So we'll have a look. Let me share the sources. Here we are. Hope everybody can see them. Okay, Effie, we're good. Elisheva, we're good. Charlotte, we're good because everybody's got the sources. Okay. Okay, so we're just going to review a few of the verses, and then we'll be in the new material. Vayomer hamelech al Yoav, hinei asna asisi as hadavar hazev, v'leich hashev es hanar es avshalom. This is where we left things off, where David yields, and he says to Yoav, you can bring back Avshalom. Avshalom, again, was hiding out in his maternal grandfather's kingdom, in Geshur, outside of the land of Israel. I bold the term Eshana'ar because David sort of has this loving, almost like a coddling perspective of Avshalom, Eshana'ar as Avshalom, where Avshalom is, you know, anything but a nar. He's not a young man. He's not a tender young soul. But he is somebody, you know, who is, you know, he's older than that, number one. And number two, he doesn't strike the sort of vulnerable perspective of the Na'ar with that implication. Vayipol Yoav al panav arza, vayishtachu, vayivarech es hamelech, vayomer Yoav hayom yada avdecha ki matzasi chein beinecha adoni hamelech, asher asa hamelech es devar avdecha. Yoav is overjoyed. Vayakom Yoav, vayilach Yeshura, vayaveyas Avshalom Yerushalayim. And so we had left things off, Avshalom in Jerusalem. Vayomer HaMelech, Yisov al Beiso, take him straight to his house, Ufanai lo yireh. I will have nothing to do with him, no contact, no communication. Vayisov Avshalom al Beiso, Ufanai HaMelech, lo ra'a. Right, this is not Yaakov and Yosef. This is not some great father-son reunion. This is not Veheshev Lev Avos al Banim Velev Banim al Avosam. Right, this is David yielding to a point. Uch Avshalom lo haya yish yafe b'chol Yisrael lehalel ma'od. That's interesting. You see that the Navi describes him not as a na'ar, but an ish. David has a soft spot. So Avshalom is very striking in his physical appearance. The Navi describes him as, you know, the most eligible, you know, man in all of Israel. Lehalel ma'od, very unusual, you know, in terms of the exuberance that you find here in this formulation. Mikaf raglo v'ad kod kagado. Lo hayavomum, from the foot to the top of his head, every part of him, there was nothing that was not immaculate. He just cuts a striking figure, to say the very least. V'golcho es rosho, interesting. The Medrash states that Avshalom is a Nazir. V'golcho es rosho, so therefore, you know, one of the restrictions of the Nazir, he's not allowed to cut his hair, but the halacha is that if you're a Nazir Olam, if you say that you're going to be a Nazir in perpetuity, that every year, on an annual basis, just because it comes too much, you're allowed to cut your hair once. V'ayami keitz yamim la'yamim asher yigaleach ki chaved alav v'gilcho v'shakal esarosho masayim shkalim be'evin hamelech. It was like this, you know, scene, he would cut his hair, and his locks would be, you know, the weight of 200 shkalim in the stone of the king. And that was, you know, itself a very impressive measure. So imagine a man, very striking appearance, with, right, long flowing hair. You know, in other words, you couldn't miss him if he was around. Vayivaldu l'Avshalom shlosha banim u'bas achas u'shma Tamar. He called her the same name as his sister, which is interesting. He, Aisa, Isha, Yifas, Mara, and she too had a very striking appearance. So we're given a little bit more of a description of Avshalom in terms of his family. We're certainly given a description of Avshalom in terms of his physical appearance. David is not interacting with him. Vayeshev Avshalom Yerushalayim Shnatayim Yamim. So Avshalom, again, waits in Yerushalayim for 2 years. And there doesn't seem to be any movement on the other side. Ufnei HaMelech Lo Ra'ah. David's not willing to make any more concessions. He is ceded to Yoav's ploy to have Avshalom brought back to Yerushalayim, but David's not having anything to do with him. So Vishlach Avshalom al Yoav, Lishloach oso al HaMelech. So Avshalom goes to Yoav to intercede on his behalf. V'lo aval avo elav. Yoav doesn't want to involve himself any further. He doesn't want to come and interact with Avshalom. So the impression one gets is that Yoav is just not responsive to Avshalom. I did what I could. I got you here, but I'm not pushing things any further. Vayishlach od shenis v'lo ava lavo. Avshalom, another request. V'lo ava lavo. Vayomer levadav re'u chalkas Yoav el yadi. So he says to his avadim. Now we've seen Avshalom speak to his avadim once before, when he told them to kill Amnon. So vayomer levadav re'u chalkas Yoav el yadi v'lo sham sorim. So you know that Yoav has a field of barley. L'chuvat sisuam. So I want you to light it on fire by ba'esh. It's a good way of getting somebody's attention. And so they burned down Yoav's field. So, you know, principle being, you try once. If at first you don't succeed, try again. If you don't succeed a second time, burn down his field. That's how it went in Avshalom's playbook. Okay. Yoav's attention, got Yoav's attention successfully. Vayakom Yoav vayavor al Avshalom abayta. Vayomer lav lama hitzisu avdecha sal chalka sheli ba'ish. So Yoav says, why'd you burn down my field? And again, Yoav's not, we're not talking about somebody who's sort of from the meek of the earth. Yoav, we meet, at the beginning of Sefer Shmuel Bet, and we talked about it, how, David was talking about Yoav as a violent figure, killing Avner, his role in the civil war, between the house of Shaul and the house of David. And it's like, Avshalom is not exactly starting up with somebody who's, a confessed Quaker, committed to a life of nonviolence. An audacious thing to do. Vayomer Avshalom al Yoav, hinei shalachti lecha leimor bohena veshlachos chalamelech leimor lamabasi migishur tov liyod anisham v'atay repnei amelech v'myesh b'yavon v'hemisani. So Avshalom said to Yoav, you got me into this mess, you brought me back from Geshur, right? I expected that, I would be rehabilitated. Here I've been 2 years. I can't get the king's attention, and I can't get your attention. So, can't have it both ways. If I'm here, I'm here. And if I haven't been rehabilitated, if there's no forgiveness, so put me to death. But I'm unwilling to accept the status quo. So, vayvo Yoav el ha-melech, vayaged lo. So Yoav comes and he tells the king what happened. Avshalom has been agitating, burned down my field. Vayikral Avshalom, so David yields again. Vayavo el ha-melech, Avshalom comes to the king. Vayishtachlo al pavartza lifnei ha-melech. Vayishak ha-melech la-Avshalom. That moment, the king kisses Avshalom. End of the chapter. Okay, so let's, have a discussion. how is our understanding of Avshalom advanced? What can we gain? What's our impression of him? We talked about his violence. We talked about his being a very calculating figure. What have we gained in terms of our understanding, and maybe even, you know, our understanding of other important figures in the story has been furthered as well. And again, here we have this critical discussion of Avshalom's appearance. We have the role of his family. So let's open it up for conversation. What do we think about Avshalom? How is our understanding been advanced? Well, I'll start with just one observation. Interested in your response to this. Once again, I think that this idea of Avshalom is capable of great violence, but in this calculated and controlled way, is confirmed, right? He doesn't show up in Yerushalayim and the next week start burning down people's fields, right? He waits 2 years, sends a messenger to Yoav, does it again. He's not getting anywhere. Violence. But, you know, as always is the case with Avshalom, it's not like violence is an end in and of itself. He uses violence. He's willing to use violence to advance certain aims. In this case, very effectively, to get what he wants. Burning down Yoav's field is an act of great violence, very risky thing to do. Again, Yoav is not a timid character. Could have responded differently, but Yoav, right, comes to him. He gets Yoav's attention. So he gets a short-term victory, but he also gets the big victory because he gets David's attention. You didn't really care about Yoav's attention. He wants to get David's attention, and he's rehabilitated. He's brought back to the palace. So it's effective. Sometimes people who are not inhibited as other people are, can be effective. So I see that dialectic again of violence and control, controlled aggression. That's one thing. Eva, go ahead. You had a comment.
I had a question, really. I was trying to understand why he wanted to see his father. And to me, it wasn't that he loved his father. It's that it was a step to the future, to be rehabilitated so he could take the next step and, you know, toward the future. But what was David's motive to wait so long? Was he so angry at his son? He obviously loved him. Was he afraid that if he saw him that it would be forgiveness for something that shouldn't be forgiven? I didn't quite understand where David came in this.
Yeah. So I was hoping we'd get to that. So maybe we'll get to that now. Yeah, Naomi, did you want to respond to that?
I have another question. Why is Yoav instrumental in bringing Avshalom back? For what purpose? And then he brings him back and then just ignores him and leaves him hanging. So there's...
You could have been Avshalom's spokesperson. He says. That's his point. He says, what'd you bring me back for?
What's in it for Yoav to have Avshalom there?
Yeah. So, this is going back almost 6 weeks. So we had, you know, explored that. It's a very good question. Is Yoav looking to ingratiate himself with Avshalom because he sees Avshalom as somebody who has a political future? I was a little skeptical of that, especially in light of tonight. I don't really think that Yoav is sort of aligning himself with Avshalom, even though that's a possibility. I consider that a little bit more remote. I think Yoav, his read of David, and this will take things back to Eva's point, his reading of David is that David is looking for reconciliation, but is conflicted. And if he can be the one that sort of brings Avshalom back, then it advances Yoav's standing. See, Eva, there's no question about this. David is absolutely conflicted. He's conflicted. And the proof that he's conflicted is the following. when people are conflicted, they become very suggestible. Instead of being proactive, they sort of start responding to what other people suggest that they should do. See, David's caught between the fact that Absalom murdered his son and the fact that Absalom is his son. It's conflict. And, you know, that's why David doesn't really know what to do. And Yoav ends up pulling the strings. Somebody who's conflicted, by definition, is suggestible. These are the scales, right? You could sort of put pressure on one side or the other. David's very conflicted.
It doesn't seem like, obviously, we're going to see things differently, but it doesn't seem like Avshalom returning. Like, it seems like kind of, it seems like he didn't do anything wrong. Like, he really, like, he, if he wants to talk to David, like, I feel like he seemingly has good intentions.
Well, right. I mean, Avshalom cannot enter the palace without permission. And David explicitly says, you are not welcome here. You are persona non grata. Right? When Yoav brings him back, the condition is you take him straight to his house. And then before Shemal comments, I don't want to see him out in the streets. But Absalom is not going to be contained. So, you know, that's why he's kind of out in the streets and he's doing this public haircutting. You know, it's attracting attention in its own right. But he's not allowed into the palace. That for sure. David doesn't know how to respond to it exactly. And for the second time, the first time being when Yoav convinces David to bring him back to Yerushalayim, David is really conflicted, doesn't know how exactly to proceed. And I'm not blaming him. It is a very thorny situation to know exactly what the best response is. But Absalom is able to seize the initiative. Yoav was willing to sort of carry Absalom's agenda forward to a point. And then, you know, when Absalom became a source of violence towards him, you know, Yoav is willing again to intercede on Absalom's behalf. So Absalom is leveraging whatever power he has. Now, again, this is not to say that David, you know, was in the end of the chapter. It's not as if, I think, for a second, all is forgotten or all is forgiven. Vayishak ha-melech l'Avshalom. There's still a certain tenderness there, the na'ar Avshalom. But again, David is, you know, got to deal with the fact that Avshalom's a murderer, number one, and number two, the murderer of his own son. That's a very serious conflict for David. You know, there's
David never did anything about the original rape.
Yeah, and that is exactly the way that the Radak interprets that line that Absalom says to Yoav, Im yesh bi avon vehemisani. You know, if I'm the guilty one here, then I'm willing to pay the consequences for it. But the reality is that I was responding to, you know, an intolerable situation. And you know, this was the way that I handled it. And once again, David is really passive, as he has been the whole time. He's really conflicted.
Did the Mefarshim address why he's a Nazir?
Yes, that's exactly what I wanted to talk about next. So let's get into the two biographical details, because I think that this really advances the story.
And my follow-up question was also, is it common to burn fields like that? Was that a common way to get attention?
No.
Because I think about the other Nazir, but anyway, go ahead. Yeah. I'm trying to connect it in my mind.
Right, yeah. That was an unconventional way of getting somebody's attention. As it is to this day. V'ad hayom hazeh. So the Ramban writes about the Nazir in very laudable terms. The Nazir is somebody who's renouncing, you know, sort of the physicality of the world to draw closer to Hashem. He has it in many different places in the essay of Kedoshim Tiyu. The Ramban has this theory that the reason the Nazir has to bring the Korban Chatas is not, as Rashi likes to quote, because he's deprived himself of wine, but rather because he's withdrawing from his Nazirus. Once you're a Nazir, you should really always be a Nazir. So to be a Nazir is basically to adopt a certain lifestyle of modesty. Judaism doesn't really believe in asceticism, but something along those lines, kind of adopting further restrictions on oneself, reducing one's engagement in the physicality of the world, more spiritual existence. So this, like, this deep irony with Avshalom being a Nazir, which is really symbolized by his hair. And the Gemara in Sota and Daf Yud speaks a lot about that. Avshalom nisga'e b'sa'aro, the Gemara says. Remember the end of the story, just a little bit of a spoiler alert over here, is that Avshalom gets hanged by his hair. His hair gets stuck in the tree. So you have this really bizarre phenomenon where he postures as a Nazir. That's his posture. Like there's some kind of a piety involved in that. But he turns, you know, the shearing of his hair into, you know, kind of a spectacle. And he's not described in any way that would give you the impression that he's withdrawn from the physicality of the world. And on the contrary, he's described in very physical terminology. Somebody for whom appearance is very important. Somebody who people identify with his physical appearance, which is sort of the opposite of, let's call it, the ethos of Nazirus. So I think that part of our understanding of Avshalom that's advanced here is as something of a fraud. And that, I think, is new. In other words, his role as Nazir is fraudulent. He's not really pious. So that's number one. Now, what about the children? The children are very interesting. And here the Mefarshim split. One school is that the reason that the Navi is introducing his children at this stage is because Avshalom was sure that David would rehabilitate him for the sake of his children. Fascinating approach is that everybody knows that grandparents, even if they, you know, aren't particularly interested in seeing their children, they can't resist their grandchildren. And Avshalom was like extremely offended that David wasn't even taking interest in the grandchildren. Interesting. Alternatively, there's another theory, be supported later on in the text with this idea of Yad Avshalom. The Navi reported here that he had three sons and a daughter. Later on, one gets the impression that he doesn't have any sons at all. Somewhat a more sympathetic presentation that Avshalom apparently lost these children in their youth, these sons, and David still won't initiate contact with him, despite the loss of his children. It's interesting. That would be a point of commonality, right? David has lost two sons. First the son from Bathsheba, and then Amnon. So that's the other school of thought, is that this is being introduced to explain some of the animus that was building between Avshalom and David. It's an interesting proposition. But what we know for certain is that Avshalom has his family, and David is not connecting with that family. Whatever one thinks happens to the sons. And I think one begins to draw the conclusion after 2 years, if we're putting ourselves in sort of in Avshalom's, you know, mindset, is that he may not be in exile anymore. He can live in Yerushalayim, but I guess this has new meaning in 2021, but he's no longer part of the royal family. And I strongly suspect, that that was the conclusion that Absalom had arrived at. That he's being brought back, but he's in this position where enough time has passed that he's concluded that his situation is frozen in place, and he's not really considered part of the family going forward. He has his own family. Maybe that's the way the Navi presents it. And what Absalom then has a choice is to accept the status quo for what it is. These are the consequences of what I did with Amnon. I'm going to have to live with it. I can raise my family here, but I'm not going to be part of the royal family, as it were. Or Absalom can do something to change the status quo. His choice is obviously the latter. He chooses to force a change in the status quo. And that's exactly what he articulates to Yoav. It's a very telling comment he makes. He says, look, either rehabilitate me, or if they think that I'm really guilty in this whole story, as Charlotte points out, right, if you really want to go back to the beginning, so then kill me. And I think that this is maybe the most revealing aspect of all. And I've tried to think a lot about this. Why do I think this is so important? Well, here's how I would articulate it. I think you can almost divide people in a binary way. There are people who are willing, basically in life, to accept the status quo. They might not be so happy about it. They might complain a little bit, but they'll make peace with it. And then you have people who are not going to accept it. They may do things that are constructive. They may do things that are destructive. Sometimes they might do both. But they're not going to be a product of their environment. They're going to shape their environment. Their environment is going to be a product of them. And I think this is a salient feature of Absalom. Absalom has been around for enough time to arrive at the conclusion that this is now the new reality. I'm over here with my children. I'm no longer in exile, but I'm basically cut off from the family. My father has arrived at this as a kind of a compromise, and I'm unwilling to accept the status quo, and I will alter my environment. I will not exist within an environment. I will shape my environment. I'll burn Yoav's field. I get his attention. Somebody else might have said, well, look, I tried. I sent not only one messenger, but two messengers to Yoav. But what am I going to do? He ignored me. What do you want me to do? Well, Absalom's response would be, burn his field down. And if Yoav comes over and says, look, what do you want me to do? You know, I can't help you anymore. And the response is, well, I'll tell you what to do. Either kill me or, you know, rehabilitate me. So you have this dynamic with Absalom, and I think it's true from the beginning, right? He didn't just accept what happened to Tamar. But he's going to shape his environment. It's not going to stand. And again, it'll be at a moment and a time and a place of his own choosing. That's part of his discipline. But I think Absalom is an important figure insofar as he like the prototype of somebody who is unwilling to allow events to dictate to him. He's going to dictate events. And here's what I think is really striking. Who should be the one dictating events? I'm going to say you in this society, who should be driving events? If you had to sort of choose one figure.
Okay.
The king, right? The melech. So Ruth, that's going to be the important term, the melech, because the question is really going to be, who is the melech? I don't mean the melech in title. I mean the real melech. And what's happening in this story, I think, is a kind of an inversion where Avshalom is driving events, he's dictating events, and David, who's very conflicted, ends up being a product of his shaping of events, that is, of Avshalom shaping of events. So what I'll try to argue going into next week is that, you know, on one level, this is all a punishment for what happened with Bathsheba, to be sure. But on the other hand, the notion of David being deposed, per se, by his son isn't just something that happened overnight. But there's actually a process that we're witnessing where Avshalom, in essence, is acting as the king. What do I mean by that? Driving events, dictating events, determining events. If that's not the king's role, then what is? So Avshalom is very important. And I think that this chapter really helps advance our understanding of Avshalom as somebody who actually is profoundly gifted as it concerns shaping events. Now again, you have to be willing to do things that other people are not willing to do. You know, I think that for those of us learning here tonight, you know, you'd say today, under what circumstances would I be willing to burn somebody's house down? I'm not presenting this as some kind of a virtue. I'm just trying to describe it for what it is. But Avshalom is willing to do it, as he was willing to kill Amnon. And yet, as we'll see next week, and I want to conclude on this note, there is something fraudulent about him. He's not a principled person. It's true that he's not out of control. That's true. His aggression exists within a framework. He waits for his moment. But at his core, he's a fraud. And this idea of him being a nazir, which should be about, you know, a certain degree of spirituality, which turns into some kind of, you know, a spectacle of his own physicality, as we see here, I think is a giveaway. There's something deeply fraudulent about who he is. And remember, David's not perfect. He's not. But what we've always admired about David is his fundamental sincerity as a person. Is Bathsheba a great failure? Of course it's a great failure. Is it a betrayal of everything that David stood for? Yes. But he's a sincere person. And he failed. And he owned up to it. And so the argument that I'm going to be making is that Avshalom, driver of events, not a product of his environment, but rather someone who really dictates his environment, seizes the throne. We'll talk about that next week, how he goes about seizing the throne. But he can never really be his father. He can never replace David. Because if there's one thing in life which really is binary, is a person sincere or are they not sincere? And Avshalom is a fraud. And that basic character trait both in David, as being a sincere person, and in Absalom, being a fraud, that basic character trait is going to be at the heart of Absalom's rebellion. The notion of deception, that's going to be critical. Because in the final analysis, Hashem chose David for one reason: his sincerity. And Absalom, it's just so interesting, very much reminds us of Shaul, the striking figure, Mishechmova Malagavo Mikol Ha'am. He looks the part, but it's deeply superficial. And the expression that we'll talk about next week, which is really the key point. Vaignov Avshalom et Lev Yisrael. He manipulates and he captures the hearts of the Jewish people, but Geneva, there's something deceptive and fraudulent about it. It's not people responding to sincerity. But he's manipulating. And that's important. Okay. So we've moved further, we've advanced in terms of our understanding of who Absalom is, who he is relative to his father. God willing, next week what we'll take a look at is the mechanism of the rebellion itself. As you would expect, nothing less from Absalom, highly choreographed, highly organized, nothing left to chance. It would have to be that way. He'll choose his time, he'll choose his place, he'll choose his moment. There's not a detail which is thoughtless. That's his MO. And we'll see all of that play itself out next week. So it's good to be back in Sefer Shmuel.